You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
From the Palmetto Swamps to the Piney Woods, to the Oak Flats. You're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast. Come on.
You're listening to the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast presented by Scree Gear, and New Year's is behind us. We are firmly into the month of January, and the after Christmas sale promotion, I hope maybe that you took an opportunity to take advantage of that if you didn't get some Scree that maybe you were hoping you might get for Christmas. And now we're in January, and there's still a lot of opportunity for deer hunting. But it is winding down, and I know a lot of guys that are listening to this, bow hunters, are also turkey hunters, and with spring turkey season coming, Scree Summit camouflage pattern is one of the best spring turkey patterns that you will ever see. In my humble opinion, I have done a ton of turkey hunting in that pattern. I've done a ton of media with it. It looks phenomenal in the spring woods, and Scree's got a number of different turkey bundles put together that will really outfit you from head to toe for this spring. Whether you're a turkey hunter that travels to numerous states across the country and so you experience a variety of different weather, or just a real basic turkey bundle, just the necessities that you would need for turkey hunting here in Louisiana. If you don't have any Scree yet and you've been thinking about it, the Summit pattern is as good as you'll get for a spring turkey pattern, and you all know exactly how important camouflage and everything is with eyesight as it pertains to turkeys, and it also translates awesome for next early season when we get back around to bow season, so it'd be a great time to look into it if you're good for the rest of the year but you've been thinking about getting some new turkey gear. Check it out. Follow them online, YouTube, social media. Find out more about the gear and shop online at ScreeGear.com. So, it's middle of January, almost the middle of January, and Levi and Colin join me on this episode. What's up, guys? Say hello.
What's going on, guys?
Hello.
So, Levi and I continue to have a miserable deer season, and
I wouldn't say that.
Well, kill stats are miserable, but as well as mine, he's had a little bit more success in terms of good hunts and opportunities than I've had. But we're all scratch as far as killing anything. It's been kind of tough, and I just led off talking about turkey season with Scree and turkey camo, and I saw a ton of turkeys this week. I hunted in Mississippi for the first time this year, and man, the turkey population looks really good. I haven't seen turkeys like that, and I'm not talking about just saw turkeys like just randomly one time. Like, there were turkeys. I saw turkeys on every hunt, and I saw turkeys throughout the weekend all over our place, and huge flocks of turkeys, like 25 and 30 of them at a time. Heard turkeys gobbling on Saturday morning. So that's exciting. But I didn't really see much for deer. I saw a few deer, but nothing like, I mean, I saw some deer, and I saw a little buck, a little spike, and a little bitty 8-point trying to chase a doe around a little bit. But it's been a tough season, and going up to Mississippi was a kind of a break in the routine of all the hunting I've been trying to do something different. But as far as deer hunting goes, my results didn't really change much. So how's it been for you guys since New Year?
Go ahead, Levi.
Mine's been...
You have a lot more to talk about than I do.
Mine's actually been, I would say, other than killing a good buck, as we talked about on the last one, I lost one. I actually had a really good 2 weeks of hunting. Saw a lot of deer. I got on the same buck, not the one I shot. It was a different buck. I had 5 encounters with him since the second week of December, and I had him inside 20 yards 3 different times over the break and could not get a shot at him. He's behind the tree, too thick, blah, 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 excuses, excuses, excuses. Just never could get a shot at him. So, I had another deer, a totally separate deer, come out chasing a doe at like 3 o'clock one afternoon. And, the doe came out and walked right exactly where I wanted her to walk, about 20, 25 yards from my tree. Perfectly, wind was perfect, everything was good. I was like, all right, this is when it's happening. This deer is dying. In 20 seconds, I'm going to kill him. And he came out of this cutover and was kind of milling around on the edge of the cutover. Well, the doe had kind of like walked through it, ate a couple acres and walked through, and the buck kind of like had happened to turn around and was like, damn, where did the doe go? So he turned around and took off sprinting right through my little hole. I was at full draw waiting on him and sitting there trying to stop him 3 different times, and he never stopped. So, but other than that, I mean, I've been seeing a lot of deer. I've passed some does up, obviously. But
yeah, I remember a text that you sent us. You said, I'm going to kill this deer this evening. I remember that text.
Well, I shouldn't open my mouth. I was
going to say, you should know better than to make definitive statements like that.
Yeah, I know. You're right.
Well,
yep.
I have had the exact same, you know, I mentioned previous podcast that the cold weather didn't do very good for me, that it seemed like everything just shut down. And I guess in the back of my mind, I was thinking when the weather kind of got back to normal for here, so to speak, that things would just kind of, you know, that the cold, that it was just that cold weather just really kind of, you know, slowed the deer movement down. And not that it was really high, but I was, from a camera perspective and from hunting, I was seeing a few deer. And it just, you know, when the cold came at Christmas, it shut down and it has not picked back up. I haven't seen deer from the tree stand, but cameras have kind of, everything has moved more nocturnal than it was before the cold. And really the only consistent thing I have going on, which has gotten more consistent than before the cold, but still, it's just does, like post-rut does, bunched back up, coming to a food. I got cameras on a bunch of food plots, just kind of monitoring what's using those food plots. And I get regular daily pictures, mostly at night, some right at dark, some here and there in the morning, of does, but the bucks have just disappeared for the most part. And I don't know. I don't know where to where to put my finger on how to figure it out. I'll say this. I know, Glenn Peterson was on the podcast with us an episode or two ago, and I talked to him today, and he hunts pretty close to Louisiana, right over in Mississippi, and they had, he said, 2 days of just unreal rut activity where it was just nonstop action. He killed another nice buck and missed a bigger one. And so, it's obviously it's just kind of sporadic all over the place, and I mean, he's not very far down the road, but, what's happening here is not what's happening there and vice versa. So it's that time of the year to me where if the weather is right, you can kind of see anything from completely dead to just crazy action, all just kind of in a flurry is how it feels.
Yeah, I hunted like 5 days in a row within the last week and saw 2 spikes in 5 days of hunting. And I'm completely lost, but at the same time, whenever I was hunting, another guy was hunting, and one day he saw a little small 8-point chasing a doe. And the very next day in the same spot, he saw 7 does and 0 bucks behind them. So I don't know if it's just kind of turning off and, slowly. I don't really know what to think about that, but
you mentioned that in a text that we were having, and it seems like it wasn't that long ago, like more around Christmas, you had some action between cameras and hunting and stuff.
Yeah, and when it was cold. It
seems to me like maybe you might be in a lockdown period.
Maybe. I've been, in those 5 days, I've been like all over the place, like different areas, trying different areas. My cameras have been dead. I mean, maybe that's what it is. But it's like reminded me of like when we were trying to film for the Solace release, it's like I can't even see a deer. Like, it's been really bad.
This happens to me sometimes. And I tell you something that's happened to me more years than I care to remember, because it's frustrating. It's madly frustrating. January is in many ways my favorite time to hunt. I like hunting post rut and late season. But a lot of times I find myself experiencing these big lulls, and then oftentimes that last week of the season, it's just fire, and then it just ends. It's like I fight it all of January, trying so hard to just figure out where the deer are and what they're doing and have some kind of plan for potentially getting on a deer. And then all of a sudden, like the last week or the last weekend of the season, it's like there's this huge rash of activity, and I'm all over deer, and things are coming together, and then boom, the season ends. That's happened to me. I can't tell you how many times I've walked out of the woods on my last day of the season to hunt, whether it be the actual last day or the last day I could hunt right there at the end, and I had just finished a 2 or 3 day span of just being, like Levi was, just like, I'm going to kill him on the next hunt. Like, I'm seeing deer, I'm seeing what I've been hunting for all year, and then it's over. That happens to me all the time. And as much as I like to hunt January, there's always these just huge lulls for me in January. And I, like for me,
hopefully,
for me, I think some of it has to do with hunting pressure. Some of it has to do with rut cycle. Some of it has to do with browse, acorns, and how the deer move. And like where I'm hunting at home, there's a lot of plantation pine, and all the food plots are in those pines. And the creek bottoms and the hardwoods that scattered around, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with this kind of landscape. they're kind of void of a lot of, especially with the cold weather we got. It kind of burned up all the acorns and browse. I mean, what was left is soured or gone. And it's really hard to bow hunt in 5 and 6 year old pines because it's just really hard. And they're pretty much nocturnal as far as coming out to the food plots because of hunting pressure. And I just feel like the deer are just changing. They don't have as much reason to be in those hardwoods. The does are in the pines. The does are around the food plot. That's where all the food is. And so, that's kind of what I feel like here in Louisiana.
If you're looking to buy your very own hunting property, or maybe you got a piece of property that you're looking to sell, you need to contact our friend Slade Priest, the Hunting Land Man, a licensed realtor with Southern States Realty and a land pro with Realtree United Country Hunting Properties. Slade's more than just a real estate agent. As the host of the Sportsman Channel television show Trained Assassins and Hunt United on the Realtree 365 app, as well as his new digital series Hunting Land Man on Waypoint TV, his life has always been centered around the outdoors and God's creation. With the ability to leverage years of experience, knowledge, and a unique perspective gained from working in the family's timber and wildlife business, Slade just understands the recreational land market, and he gets results. Nobody sells more in Mississippi and Louisiana. To search for your new hunting property, visit huntinglandmanms.com or contact Slade at 601-888-0094 for a free consultation.
Like with you, Colin, your property that you're talking about is a whole lot more like my property in Mississippi, in that there's a lot of hardwood around there and stuff like that. And I feel like there's just between kind of a post-rut cycle and just an immense amount of pressure for the last 3 months, the deer are just getting really hard, and you just really got to catch just the right weather change, weather pattern on top of that, kind of combined with some late estrus does, is really kind of the secret. And how to figure that out is, I don't know. If you know that, bottle it up and package it and sell it, and you'll be a rich man.
Yeah, I wanted to – it's funny, when you were talking, Levi, you said that doe was kind of coming through feeding on some of those acorns. And a week, kind of right around the new year, I was hunting in the woods, and there was acorns falling out of the tree, like in the trees that I was sitting in. And then it's been so slow, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. And I didn't really think about the lockdown thing, but that's interesting. But I'm just wondering what's y'all's thoughts? I mean, I know it's obviously the whole acorn deal is obviously usually gone or done by now. But I mean, do you think that they're still at my place, at least they could just be milling around in the woods on these acorns and not moving far, or I don't know, but that thought did kind of run through my mind the other day when I was sitting there and acorns were dropping right next to me.
I don't know. That's kind of like a $1 million question on how your property's laid out. I know, going back to what you said with when you saw those, when you were seeing two spikes and that small 8-point going around, and Locke mentioned it, that his opinion was you're probably, maybe the deer were kind of in a lockdown phase. And that's one thing that I've noticed on our place, that, you have a really, really good week of rut activity or so, week and a half maybe, and then you start seeing all kinds of small bucks just up roaming around everywhere. Spikes, 4-points, all young deer. You don't see any mature deer. They're all roaming around just kind of in random places. You may see them when walking down some roads. Yeah. I tend to think, and it's just my opinion, I think that the mature deer at that point are typically probably with a doe somewhere. And, the best, and I do it during the rut every year, you just kind of keep tabs of, where certain little doe groups might hang out. But, the best thing you can do at this time of year, in my opinion, is, you know, bounce around to different areas where you know does hang out, and you just got to get lucky. You just got to be close to them, and hopefully there's one that's hot at that point that, you know.
Yeah.
That yeah, once I mean, a mature deer comes off a doe and you know, he's up roaming and looking. So
the best area, you know, we've had a couple, me and a couple other people hunting when I was hunting, and there's really only been one area that deer are even getting seen at. And like with the little buck and the seven does, it's all like in one area. And we're trying other spots on the complete other end of the property while people are on this side. And like one side is like pretty good, I guess, kind of. I mean, you're seeing some deer, and the other side is just nothing, completely dead. And I mean, Locke obviously knows the property, but it's just, or he's seen the property.
Well,
it's just baffling to me.
You know, there's a commonly discussed topic about acorns that, you know, not every tree, not every acorn that's falling and hitting the ground is really that attractive or palatable to a deer that, you know, there's, you know, not to say that they won't eat them, but they prefer an acorn at a certain point, you know, and I would have to assume that even after that acorn is laid on the ground for a certain amount of time, the more it gets wet, the change in temperature and everything, it's like any other food. So it could be that area you're talking about on your camp has some kind of natural food, you know, likely acorns that are, for whatever reason, more desirable at this time of the year than the trees in the other parts. You know, I don't know how to guess. I don't know how to guess what all that is, like what reasons all that would be, but whether it's low ground, high ground, or sunlight based on age of the maturity of the timber in one area or what, but I know I've experienced it, and I've heard a lot of podcasts and heard a lot of people that have really kind of paid attention to it throughout their lives that, you know, deer are kind of, they pick and choose on those acorns, and they definitely prefer certain trees over the others. And that changes throughout the year as the trees, I guess the word ripe is applicable.
And it also changes every year too, just because they hit one tree real hard one year, next year, I mean, you're not guaranteed for that to be a hot tree next year. So
yeah, like I was talking to my dad, and you know, I'm hunting in the woods some, on food plots some, and on our food plots we have feeders. And I wanted to talk to you specifically about this, Levi. Well, both of y'all, but you know, at your place, or first off, is y'all's food plots, is it just rye, or what is it?
Weed oats and clovers.
Weed oats and clovers.
Primarily.
Okay.
Because
I was talking to him, and I'm like, we're just like, we're not seeing any deer on these food plots. And like, I've kind of made a mental note over the past like two seasons in it. Like I don't feel like our deer are using our food plots at all. Like, I just feel like they're coming out and eating at the feeder. So
have you ever put up a browse enclosure?
No.
You know what I'm talking about? Or have you ever seen those?
Like enclosing it?
Well, no, not the food pot itself, but if you go out there and take a T-post in your food pot, or around, if there's like a small tree out in your food pot or something, and drive your T-post out there, and once you plant plant the food plot and take you some field fence or some chicken wire, probably put two or three T-posts up and build you a small little enclosure, maybe in 3 or 4 foot around where the deer can't like reach inside of it and eat the grass.
And yeah.
See how high
it'll,
that grows.
It'll tell
see
you.
See if it gets higher yeah. versus the other.
Yeah, yeah. You compare it to,
well, you know,
your browse level.
I think it has a lot to do with the property itself and how much natural forage it has on it, just because of geography or timber management or whatever. But, you know, a lot of these fall seed mixes and stuff, you know, some of that is for diversity and providing a lot of different things to the deer in way of nutrition. But some of that is because, you know, you have a 7-way, a 6-way, 5-way, all the way up to like a 10-way mix. And a lot of that is because there's plants in there that become more attractive to the deer at different times of the year. So you constantly have something growing in the plot from early season right. through late season that the deer are want to eat. So I don't know it well enough to name what plants at what time and all that, but you have some things in there that sprout up real quick and the deer start eating them right there in October and they eat them through the first part of the fall. And then you have other things in there that they don't really become as palatable and as sought after by the deer until late season. And they don't, you know, they grow much slower. And that way your food plots remain sustainable for a longer period of time instead of just planting something that sprouts up and grows for a couple months and then they're done with it by Thanksgiving or December, you know, for the most right. part. So,
yeah, I was, what I was telling them, I'm like, dang, like, when we were up at your place, I'm like, we're going out on these evening hunts at, you know, 1:30, 2, whatever. And there's already deer out there just eating and feeding around. And I was just kind of talking. I'm like, we don't ever see that at our place. And I was like, I know, like you said, y'all don't really hunt much, but I mean, over the food plots. And I was just wondering, like, you think that could have anything to do with it or what?
And possibly.
Answer that. I have like one more thing I want to.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit of it, but you got to remember too, when you were over there on our place, how wonderful the weather is. And, you know, it was cold. It was pretty clear, I think, every day that we hunted. And those bluebird, cold, high pressure afternoons or when you really see those deer out in those food plots. That's what I see. I can't speak for everywhere in the country, but if it's, you know, say it's in the 40s or, you know, low 50s, my perfect temperature is like, you know, high 20s, low 30s in the mornings, low 50s in the afternoons, into the high 40s. And if the sun's out, zero clouds in the sky, I guarantee you go sit around those food plots and probably starting about 1:30 or 2 o'clock, you'll start to see deer feeding out in them and they'll stay out there all afternoon. Why that is, I have no clue, but like right now, I guess the last few days I hunted, I didn't see any deer in any food plots. It was hot. I mean, it was in the 60s, 70s yeah. a little bit. On those overcast, warm, low-pressure days, I don't hardly ever see deer out in food plots really browsing around eating. I just don't. And that's just strictly my observation. I'm probably dead wrong if you talk to half the people in the country about deer.
That's
just what I see.
I would agree with you because just over the course of a lifetime of hunting lots of different properties that have food plots, I would agree that cold, clear, high pressure days, you see more food plot activity than anything, than any other type of condition. I mean, I'm just speaking from observed what I can recall from just years of hunting Louisiana and Mississippi, and a lot of different styles of hunting, where from a camp atmosphere with a lot of pressure to much more managed property that's got better habitat and everything. The deer, for whatever reason, they feed earlier and they feed on grass more in those conditions, in my opinion, from what I've observed. And I...
Do you think...
No, go ahead. I don't know.
I was just saying, Levi, do you think that... So y'all don't run feeders or anything? Y'all have feeders or anything like that? Do you think you're getting... I mean, I think you are. You're getting, like, the most just natural, like, deer movement that you possibly can. Like, they're just going where they want to go. They're not going because a feeder's throwing out corn. I mean, you think that has a big... Like, you think you can kind of, like, figure them out easier without, like, if they're on that supernatural, like flow pattern of them?
I mean, I could see that because, I mean, and this has probably been discussed before. I think Kyler even, I heard him say this last year, that you get the opportunity to watch deer be deer. They're not right. Focused on some artificial food source that some guy goes, they like the deer obviously know that, you know, all right, 1:30 when that four-wheeler cranks up at that camp, yeah. He's going to that food plot. So
yeah,
we're getting the hell out of here. But
hey, it's Brian Chamberlain with Movement Mortgage. We're happy to be back for a second year supporting Louisiana Bowhunter. Just want to let you know that we're here for all of your mortgage needs, whether it's a purchase, a refinance, a renovation loan, or to take equity out of your home. We're also an equal opportunity lender, so whether you shoot a crossbow, a compound bow, a fixed blade, or an expandable, we're here for all of your mortgage needs. You can reach us at 504-228-3780 or at chamberlainteam@movement.com. Movement Mortgage, NMLS number 39179, Brian Chamberlain, NMLS number 114586, licensed in Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, and Florida.
You know, it's, I'm not going to say it's easier, but I guess if people, you know, if somebody wants to say that deer pattern the hunter, you kind of become right. Unpatternable, I guess, if you're, you know, if you're not sitting there hunting over something like that.
I think the problem, I think the problem that a lot of people end up having, I think this is probably very common, is they don't have a wide variety, diversity in places they can go and change. I mean, maybe they have the acreage to do it, but like in my case, I mean, I have a little bit of diversity, but I have 400 acres, and I'm just lucky that on my 400 acres, there just happens to be some swampy area that they couldn't cut. Otherwise, it would be less. And I mean, I've got some pretty big chunks, but you can't, I mean, the only way you can hunt it is to either hunt on the road or hunt in the food plot, because it's 6-7 year old pines. It's, you know, you don't really have a choice, but yep. to hunt those places. And, you know, if you hunt in a place where you've got some staggered timber management, so you've got some thicker, some older cuts, some fresher, thicker cuts, you've got food plots, you got right-of-ways and maybe pipelines, and you got some different things, you can move around and try different things to figure out what the deer are using to find food and kind of base their movement patterns off of maybe different landscape opportunities. But when you're hunting a 200 acre lease and 180 acres of it is a pine thicket, and you got a couple food plots, you don't really have anywhere else to hunt. So I don't know what advice to give that person, because other than find somewhere else to hunt, because
that's a good point.
Once the deer get to the point where they've kind of patterned you, they've smelled you and heard you around those food plots so often throughout the whole season, you basically got to have a hot doe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And in saying that, you know, on a smaller piece of property, I would definitely take into consideration how small your property is on how you want to hunt it, because I've killed some pretty nice deer in Minden back behind my dad's house. Since then, there've been some houses built back there, and pressure's gone way up. It's just not as lucrative as it used to be. But I mean, I was hunting a 10-15 acre block of timber behind a pond. There's nothing there. It's a little thicket right behind a pond, but you know, I would greatly limit myself going in there to like two or three times a year, because the smaller the property, the less it's going to sustain pressure that you're going to be able to put on it. And it depends on like what it is. Like Locke said, you know, it may be if you're hunting 400 acres and three quarters of it's, you know, 6-7 year old pines they use for bedding, like deer like, I mean, that's obviously what just about everybody keys in on, is a change in habitat or something to look. That's where just about everybody starts to look. Like, you got a pine thicket here, swampy area here, you're going to look, okay, well, if I see that, the first place I'm going to is going to be that change in habitat to go look for deer sign. Absolutely. 100%. So.
Yeah. We were talking, and this is really what I was getting at and wanted to hear y'all's thoughts, is we were thinking about next year just completely doing away with all the feeders and putting more money into the food plots and trying to produce like a better plot with like more diversity, like you were talking about, Locke, you know, throughout the whole season. And I just wanted to know what y'all's thoughts were on
that. My thought is, I don't have a negative thought towards it, but, and I obviously have been on the property, but I don't know it over the course of a season or anything. But I think that food plots, as a general rule, are a disadvantageous place for a deer, and they know it. They're in the open, right? And for them to come out in the open, regardless of what you provide them nutrition-wise and all that, they've got to feel comfortable to come out in the open in the daylight. Just period, you know? And so no matter what you do to your food plots on private land, in a club setting or whatnot, if those food plots are getting a lot of pressure both by hunting and traffic, in my opinion, you're going to struggle. The food plots may serve a vital purpose in providing, you know, providing nutrition for your holding capacity, but to successfully have deer on those food plots in the daylight, most of the time on days when you expect movement in the daylight, you've got to really manage the pressure, you know. I think one of the reasons that, you know, you referenced Levi's place, I mean, one of the reasons that they see a lot of deer on food plots is they don't hunt over them. You know, those deer for generations have been used to seeing people drive by at a distance, but they don't ever walk out in a food plot and smell somebody sitting right on the edge of that food plot, or see another deer get shot off of that food plot. You know, they don't hunt them very much. So the deer, it's just like the deer that are in your backyard. I mean, I can give this example very well because my son hunts right off of my backyard in the woods. And there's deer in my backyard from time to time, and we don't mess with them. And if you walk out the door and there's a deer back there, they won't stay there forever, but they're comfortable coming out there, and they'll stand there and look at you, and they'll just kind of slowly make their way off if you stay out there for too long. But if you step off of the backyard into the woods and you walk up on a deer, it acts exactly how you would expect. It blows and runs off and tears the woods apart getting out of there. Because
we actually used to hunt over food plots growing up. I rifle hunted. I guess I started bow hunting when I was 13. I haven't rifle hunted since, but when we were growing up little, we had some box stands out in food pots, but I don't know. It's been, good Lord, I can't tell you the last time on our main property that anybody has hunted over one of those with the rifle or bow for that matter, really.
Yeah.
They, like said, I mean, you can, those food plots are kind of intertwined in the CRP field, and man, if you look and pay attention well enough, like driving up and down our roads, and I've probably told y'all this before, but once the foliage gets off the trees and stuff, you can, if you really pay attention and look out through that CRP, you can find deer. You can see deer just sitting out there just watching you. Like if you drive by, as long as you don't stop, they'll be 30, 40 yards over there, you know, behind a little briar thicket, just sitting there watching you, just laying down.
Yeah.
If you stop.
Right.
Most of the time they'll get up and.
Yeah.
But.
Do you think the feeder alone running from, you know, September through January or February, that feeder alone is like adding pressure to your place just because they know it's not natural?
No, I don't know if I would say that, but you know, if you're just say, how big is y'all's place, Colin? You don't mind me,
it's
like acreage wise?
350 acres.
Okay. Well, let's say you've got 350 acres and then you've got three neighbors that got likewise comparable size tracks that they hunt. And all right, you don't just say you don't hunt over food plots. You got your feeder out there, but say all three of your neighbors got feeders over food plots. They rifle hunt. They hunt them every day. I can guarantee you that your deer on your 350 acres, I can tell you almost with certainty that they absolutely venture off around on those adjoining properties. And
oh yeah, no doubt.
They dang well know,
right?
If those things are hunted with any
consistency, mine ain't gonna be. They're not gonna look at mine any different than theirs.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I'm not sure. You know, I think what happens in most scenarios, I say most scenarios, a lot of scenarios with feeders is people, they set up a deer stand in relation to a feeder, and they basically just play a numbers game. They hunt it enough until a deer makes a mistake and walks out there in the daylight. But,
right,
you know, the deer is, it's like anything else. There's an exception to every rule. So a big buck walks out there from time to time. You see a picture of somebody killed a deer, a big buck, and it followed a doe or it came out there in the daylight or whatever. But, you know, what is it doing all the rest of the time, you know, and how is it affecting deer movement and all that kind of stuff? And I think it's hard to say, but I, on the one hand, I don't subscribe to any kind of theory about deer having cognitive thought ability. They can't cognitively decipher things the way that we can as humans. And so with that in mind, there's only so many two and twos they can put together, you know, in the way that in what they're capable of. But they obviously have some ability to decipher the difference between natural and unnatural food sources.
Right.
And I think the feeder itself also becomes a hub of human activity, from the camera that somebody's checking around that feeder, from the feeder itself being checked and filled up and battery changed or reprogrammed, and then of course the hunting that's around it and the scent that's left all around it, and that's happening all year long. And so I do think that, like, all of those things thrown in the pot and mixed up together, those are pressure points on any piece of property, you know. So if you take that from another angle and say, let's just say you have a piece of property where you don't have a lot of acorns, you don't have a lot of food plot opportunity, and what you do is kind of limited in, you know, how big they are and what all you can really do with them. And you put feeders out and you don't hunt around them. You put them in areas where you don't disturb them. You just leave them there for the deer to eat from them. They're not, you know, whatever they are. They're big enough. They're set up well enough that you don't have to visit them very often. And you just leave them there just to feed the deer and keep them around. How is that? In my mind, it should create a very different atmosphere than the feeder that's sitting 20 to 50 yards from a ladder stand, and it's getting, there's a human in that ladder stand two or three times a week at least throughout the entire season, you know?
Yeah.
I could definitely see it both ways, because if you got a little local group of deer on your property, that the way Locke said, if you put your feeder up in some secluded area that you absolutely don't ever go in, I think eventually the deer do kind of, I guess, get used to it. I mean, I don't see why they wouldn't.
Well, just think about, but, like, the things that are out in a home area, so to speak. You know, there's something out in your yard that's completely foreign to a deer, but they walk across your yard day and night all the time. They go out there and feed on the acorn trees in the back of the yard, stuff like that. Nothing ever disturbs them. Nothing ever bothers them. And so whatever's out in the yard with them, they just become used to it. They don't associate it with anything because there's never anything to associate it with. You know, and so I think that that is a real thing for however deer perceive the world. I think that's a real thing. But at the same time, you can't discount the idea that if there is an association occurring with this unnatural thing, that they can't somehow figure that out, and that can't somehow become a problem for you.
Yeah.
I'm not, in the way I explained it earlier, I'm not saying that the deer is going to walk out in your food plot and say, oh, that's a boss buck feeder right there. There's a human over there on the wood line. You know, I don't think they think of it like that.
Yeah.
But they
just know something.
Yeah, enough to make them uncomfortable, I guess.
Well, I think kind of part of where we're at right now in this conversation, you know, stems from food plots. And I guess it, to kind of tie that up with kind of what you were talking about and asking, Colin, is I don't necessarily think it's the feeder, that it's not just the feeder. But let's just say it this way. If you took all the feeders off your property and you improved the food plots with better, more diverse seed, better fertilizing, and the food plots were just better, and there were no feeders on them, but the hunting activity didn't change. You were still driving through those food plots, going from A to B. You're still hunting over them, you know, a lot throughout the season. I don't think the feeder makes that much difference. The getting deer to come out in food plots in the daylight is about the human presence, and the feeder is just one of the catalysts for human presence, I guess is a way to put it. So, and to Levi's point, if all of your neighbors have food plots and they've got stands on them and that's all they hunt, then the deer don't know the difference between yours and theirs, and so you're kind of fighting an uphill battle with that.
Yeah.
But I also think that I've seen this as a kid. I can remember as a kid, I grew up hunting in a humongous deer lease in Mississippi. Like huge, 30-something members and thousands of acres, like back when there were really, really big hunting clubs. And we probably had something like 40 food plots scattered throughout this place. Now, I want to say our lease was like 12 or 13,000 acres. Literally, it was ginormous. And you could literally, there were food plots that never got hunted just simply because we had so many of them. And you could go to a food plot that hadn't been hunted all year, and there'd be deer out there at 3:30 in the afternoon. And then some of your more common, more popular food plots, that people hunted all the time, they would start to dry up middle of the season. And so I think there's something to that too. I mean, I think it, when it comes to food plots, like the amount of human activity that the deer encounter is just going to be, have a direct relationship to how comfortable they are coming out in the open in the daylight. Because regardless of what we know or what we can decipher about how they're able to perceive the world and how they're able to, you know, their thought processes and stuff like that, I don't think there's any doubt that we all know that a deer knows good and damn well when he's out in the wide open. You know?
Yeah.
And they are absolute masters at sensing pressure.
Yeah.
And smelling, and they know where they're safe. It is, yeah.
Well,
it amazes me every year that they are just that keen on their environment.
The best analogy I've ever heard, and I've probably used it in conversation multiple times because it just makes the most sense to me, even though I can't really define it exactly. It makes the most sense to me, and that is, you know, someone explained, you go in and out of your house every day. You know, you live in your house. You watch TV in your living room. You sleep in your bedroom. You feed your family in your kitchen, and you're in and out of your house every day. And if you came home from work one day and there was a stranger hiding in your living room and you walked in, you could feel it. Something's different in that house. It's just how you know, sometimes you walk in a room and you can tell something's not right before you realize what's out of place, because you're there all the time. That's your world, and you know it better than you even realize you know it. And you know, you walk into your bedroom, and before you even identify what your wife has changed, you know something's not right, and you have to look for it to figure it out, but you know it as soon as you walk in there. Something's different. And I think that in that same way, deer are kind of that way. If they approach an oak flat that they feed in on a day-to-day basis, they walk through that oak flat all the time, they know it, they smell it, they see it all the time, and then one day they walk in there and there's a dude sitting up in a tree at 18 feet. They may not see him, but they can sense something. I don't know how that works. I think it's for all beings, not just deer, but human have that kind of perception. Probably not as honed as a deer, because a deer's, you know, every day under a threat of survival. But, you know.
Yeah, they spend 80% of their life
trying to stay alive.
Scared and running.
You know, it's kind of, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the same concept that you hear from people when someone becomes blind or deaf or they lose one of their senses, their other senses heighten.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the food plots or anything else is that they're so keen that they have that sixth sense about them, you know, and they know when something's not right. And I think that's when they're just really, really comfortable with food plots where the pressure's just managed well, they will use them in the daylight. And I think that has more to do with it than the feeder.
Yep.
Long drawn out. Probably not completely correct response.
All of our points are absolutely not correct, I'm sure. But it's fun to talk about anyways.
I guess so.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess one more thing I wanted to ask y'all was, like, how many, whether it be deer or pigs, like, so all three of us shoot mechanical broadheads. How many animals are you shooting through before you just like switch to, not like a different like brand, but just like get switch to a like a sharper one that hasn't been shot through animals? Or are you sharpening, or how many is it? What do you think?
Oh, if I shoot a deer with a broadhead, I'm swapping blades out every time.
Oh, just one animal immediately?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I always swap out. Now, I've got severs on my arrows this year, and I've shot them before. They're good broadheads. I really like the fact that you can put the little screw in there and actually practice with the broadhead that retains the blades. I've shot Rage for years. I shot Grim Reapers. I like the Grim Reapers too. The Rages, I actually bought a, for anybody that cares, I bought a little tool that I saw on the internet. It works kind of like a Lansky sharpener. Do y'all know what a Lansky knife sharpener is?
Yep, I have one.
Okay. Well, there's a tool on the internet that it works similar to a Lansky sharpener. It's a little wedge that you can take a Rage broadhead, take the blade off, and it holds it in there, and you can rub them on a stone and sharpen them really easily with it. So
my take has always been, honestly, for a very short, I mean, I've been shooting nothing but Grim Reapers since like 2007. So I'm not the best to comment from that perspective, because, you know, it's kind of been the same thing for 15 years now. But before that, I've shot a few, like a G5 Montech or a Landshark or something that wasn't replaceable blade. And one of the things I hated about it was I'm not great at sharpening things. And I never know when to say enough is enough. I don't know. I'm just not good at that. And so I've kind of always, even before I started shooting Reapers, I've always tried to shoot a replaceable blade broadhead. And my take on it was, in the grand scheme of things, just replace the blades. And then obviously, I'm going to shoot a broadhead as far as the broadhead itself, unless it gets damaged, unless I can, you know, spin it or visibly see something wrong, any nick or damage to it, I'm not going to shoot it again. But if there's no damage to the broadhead, I'm just going to replace the blades. And I just don't try to replace, like, sharpen. I mean, on all these replaceable blade style broadheads, I'm just not going through the right trouble to, yeah, say. To me, I shoot, on a good year, I shoot 4 or 5 deer, you know. And from a financial perspective and from everything, just it just makes the most sense to me to just replace the blades. They're not expensive enough for me to lose sleep over trying to figure out how to sharpen a little bitty broadhead blade.
Now, I would agree with that. It takes a Rage, Grim Reaper, any of them, Sever, whatever replacement blade you want to talk about. It takes 15 seconds to take the little Allen head out and put some new blades in, and you're ready to go. You're not spending 15, 20 minutes resharpening your broadheads. Or my dad, he still shoots feathers with Zwicky broadheads. Nothing wrong with it. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. But if he gets rained on or kills a few deer with them, he's in there refletching at night in the camp. You know, I shoot veins, I get a pass through, wipe the air. Really don't even have to wipe the blood off the air. Pop the blades off, 15 seconds, and air is ready to go.
I think at some point I had a conversation about this either on a podcast or somewhere at some point, and I just kind of laid it out from the perspective of the amount of time and effort that we all go through to find ourselves in the situation to get a chance to execute a kill shot on a deer. When you consider you owe it to yourself. It's simple. When you do all of that work and you spend all that time and money to get to that place in time where you have a legit opportunity to make a lethal shot on an animal, why cut corners and try to convince yourself that you can sharpen an already shot little bitty disposable thin piece of metal when you can just spend $20 and replace them? In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And to be quite honest with you, like, not everybody is going to agree with this, but to be quite honest with you, given the marketplace, why would you shoot something that you had that was that labor intensive when there's so many better options in my mind that are just eliminate any possibility for equipment malfunction or error, whether it be from sharpness or from you dinging a blade, trying to sharpen in it, or you know, doing anything in that fashion, why wouldn't you just shoot something that you can put brand new? Now, the argument can be made that, oh, I can sharpen it sharpener than it, more sharp than it comes from the factory. And if that's the case and you really feel that these things aren't sharp enough to kill a deer out of the package, then, you know, to each his own. But
I've never shot a deer and thought that, oh, that broadhead wasn't sharp enough to kill that deer. Ever. Straight out of the package. And I have, that's, I get worked up when somebody wants to blame their broadhead. Now, if you shoot a 2.5-inch mechanical and shoot him in the shoulder at 50 yards, yeah, you're probably not going to get penetration, but it's not the broadhead's fault that you shot him in the shoulder. I get worked up when I read it on the internet or hear somebody say that it was the broadhead's fault. You did not hit the deer in the right spot. Do not. Don't even go there. That drives me insane.
That whole sharpening, like you buy new broadheads and then you sharpen them to make them sharper, that's like a thing with these fixed blades now.
Like they, I just they don't understand.
They air quote, don't come sharp enough.
I just don't understand.
Yeah, I don't either.
I mean, it's like you're trying to make something out of nothing, in my mind. Yeah. Like, you are just intentionally trying to make life difficult on yourself. For what? To prove a point to somebody that you can sharpen better than the factory? Yeah. Because, like Levi said, if you make a good... Now, don't get me wrong.
That lung's going to stop that.
There's something to be said for somebody who doesn't have their gear set up correctly, right? Okay, so you're shooting an arrow and a broadhead and a bow that's not tuned, it's not all, and so, you know, your accuracy and your execution with the bow is iffy and, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's something in there where the broadhead doesn't perform because it's on an arrow that's not really set up well for the bow, and the bow's not really all that kind of stuff. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the bow is set up. You've shot the bow. You're shooting the right size, the right weight, the right spined arrow. You're shooting the right weight broadhead. Everything is good. And just for some reason, at nearly 300 feet per second, that broadhead just wasn't sharp enough to cut through soft tissue. Like magically, it just wasn't.
Yeah.
So, well, at that angle, the arrow, well, you shouldn't have shot at that freaking angle then. Like, you know, like there's something to that. Especially as we sit here in 2023 with the performance of the equipment that we have, it's just hard to imagine, even if the blades are not as sharp as your grandpa can get them on his old whetstone, if you shoot a freaking deer at 25 yards broadside through the vitals, you can shoot a damn butter knife at him and it's going to cut his ass wide open. You know, I mean, it just seems like an unnecessary amount of labor, and it also seems like a kind of a pain pinch point for you to cause a problem that didn't exist by fooling with your equipment unnecessarily is kind of how I look at that. So with all that being said, we're going to wrap up the episode with one last thing here. We're talking about equipment. I'm leaving tomorrow to go to the ATA show. So I'll be at the ATA show. And if y'all aren't familiar, ATA is the Archery Trade Association, and it's their yearly like show and convention. And basically this is not like your Louisiana Sportsman Outdoor Expo where all the, you know, you can go buy all this stuff and all these vendors. It's more of a business to business type show. It's basically where stores go to meet with manufacturers and write inventory orders for the year and see all the new products that are coming out and decide what they want to put on their store shelves. So when you go to the ATA show every year, there's a lot of cool things that happen at the ATA because a lot of the companies kind of debut their newest products, in everything from accessories to arrows and broadheads and bows themselves and camo and cameras and everything. So I just wanted to kind of ask each one of you, I guess I'm, I don't know what my schedule's going to be like, but are there things that you've seen that, that are supposed to be being debuted at the ATA that you want me to look at or that you're interested in seeing something new that, that you've seen coming out on the market?
Actually, yeah, I do have one thing. Usually they don't even – sometimes they'll kind of hint and tease at something new being released, but usually they don't just show it until the show. But XOP has what looks like done a little bit of a rebrand, and they actually posted a video yesterday. And there's clips of new – everything's new for XOP this year from the from what I can tell. So they have some sticks that look exactly like some other sticks on the market right now. But yeah, I would, I'm curious if you would go, if you have time, go check out the XOP booth and see the new stands. And in the video, I've seen like two new stands, a new saddle platform, two new sets of sticks. It all is completely different. None of it looks the same as what you have and have used and everything. So,
Well, it's not on their website.
I'm curious.
It's not on their website. A lot of these companies will start like here leading up the week, you know, week before and stuff like that. They'll start releasing some stuff to just sort of build up anticipation and get more traffic to their booth.
Yeah.
For the show.
Anybody who is listening and they are curious, this is on XOP's YouTube channel, so it's called, I think the video, like their new slogan is called like "Change is Good." So it's like a 3-minute video on their YouTube. You can go watch it and see the sneak peeks, and then over the next couple of days, I'm sure videos will be released and whatnot. So that's it for me.
That's one of the things. I'm gonna check that out because I'm. I'm constantly battling
gear mode with
trying to swap and change and do this and do that, and I've yet to get my gear set up narrowed down exactly. Every time I get something right, then I change something.
Gotta buy something else.
Eventually. Yeah. I will say this. Since the week before Christmas, I've hunted out of my saddle more than I have end of last year or any leading up to this year. I've actually saddle hunted quite a bit. And so that's been new. I haven't shot at anything. But I've had a couple of opportunities where I had to pick my bow up and kind of I had a doe coming Saturday afternoon, and I could tell there was a buck following her. Unfortunately, it was a spike, so. You know, when it finally showed up, it was just a spike. But I'm still in wait and see mode because I was sitting there, kind of got myself in position. The deer was going to be on my strong side, like I hoped, and everything. But I was still thinking, man, this is fixing to be a goat roping when I try to draw this bow back and shoot. I was sitting there balancing on that freaking platform, leaning to one side. I had my bow, and I was ready, and I was like this doe standing there, and she was fixing to bring him right by me. And if it had been a deer I was going to shoot, I was thinking, I guess mostly what I was thinking was, well, here we go. I hope this goes well.
The deer's like coming in, and you're like watching the deer, and then you glance at your bridge, and you look at the deer, and then you glance at your platform, trying to like figure out I do now?
Well, I had another situation on the same hunt where I was kind of on the side of a hill, and it was a real thick area about 40 yards along the side of the hill down from me, and I kind of caught a glimpse of a deer, and so I knew a deer was coming through that, and I had no idea what it was. It ended up being a doe. But I had no idea what it was, but the way the situation was, I don't know how to really lay this out that well, but I basically had a short window of time where the deer was coming downhill through this thicket, and it was going to pop out in an opening at the base of the hill, and I had about maybe 10 or 15 yard wide opening where when it popped out at the base of the hill, I had just that width of an area to get a shot. And it was going to be like a 25-yard broadside shot. But if it hit the bottom of the hill and kept walking, I mean, it was going to walk right through that opening quickly, potentially. And it was on my weak side. And so I saw the deer. I heard the deer first, and then I saw it moving through there, and I knew it was fixing to pop out. And I had to try to rotate around to my weak side. And I'm just here to tell y'all right now, it could have been a 200-inch world-class state record buck, and I could not have shot it because I could not get myself in a situation. I mean, it was directly to my weak side, and I might could have made an effort, but it would have been.
Well, you would have had to do like what that guy did in that picture.
Yeah. Turn upside down.
Like Spider-Man.
Yeah. But I've gotten really good at getting up and down the tree. I've at least gotten that far. So anyway. Promise. All right. Well, I guess if there's no other gear that y'all want to mention, I'll try to report back on all the cool stuff that I see. I'll definitely make time to go shoot a bunch of the new bows and see if there's anything there that surprises me or whatnot. But it'll be cool. It's always a cool show to be able to go to. And just, I really have noticed over the last couple of years, there's kind of a plateau in technology. You know, there's some new stuff, but a lot of it is just very minor tweaks to some of the same innovation. But so I've gotten a little bit callous over the years because there hasn't been a whole lot of just really groundbreaking new innovation to hit the market. But I'll be curious to see, and I'll definitely give a report back on what cool stuff I see. And I fully suspect that while I'm gone, that'll be January the 10th through the 14th. So I would expect that the weather is going to be good and the deer hunting is going to be phenomenal while I'm gone. So y'all go ahead and get prepared for that. Y'all should probably plan to hunt over the next 3 or 4 days because I suspect that it's going to be lights out while I'm off and unavailable to hunt. But the last thing that we're going to do is we need to announce the winner of our December giveaway just to remind you, what we do is every order placed on our website throughout the month, we do a drawing the first of the following month for a gear package from every order placed. So even if you place more than one order in the month, you get in the drawing more than once. And this December's drawing is a Moultrie cellular trail camera and a Louisiana bow hunter hat and t-shirt. And the winner is Richard Davis from Doosan, Louisiana. Am I saying that right? Doosan? D-U-S-O-N, Doosan?
I would think.
I guess.
If you're listening, I sent you an email earlier, as well as we posted on the story and everything. So.
Yeah, so be looking for that, Richard, if you happen to listen to this. And we'll do one more gear giveaway this year for the month of January. So we've got to decide what that gear package is going to be, but we'll make that announcement soon. Every order placed during the month of January on our website will be entered in that drawing the first part of February, and we'll make that announcement. So until then, hopefully there's some post-rut action happening around the state this week and going into this weekend. Hope everybody's able to get out and take part in that and kind of have a good getting towards the end of the season. But remind you about the film contest.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What was that?
What was that?
That had to be Levi. Anyway, remind you about the film contest. We'll be starting to take entries into the film contest in February. So be looking for that information coming soon. And we really appreciate you listening. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Louisiana Bowhunter Podcast. If you have anybody you'd like to hear on the show, reach out to us at info@louisianabowhunter.com. And if you want to help support Louisiana Bowhunter, go by your local archery shop and pick up some merchandise. If you don't have any at your local shop, let us know and we'll reach out to them. Or pick up your gear at louisianabowhunter.com and we'll ship it out to you same day. See you next week.